You know, there's this really classic storytelling trope that we just absolutely love. I mean, it's practically hardwired into our modern brains at this point.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, you see it everywhere,
Yeah.
right? From sweeping historical epics to massive sci-fi franchises, it's that image of the scrappy little band of freedom fighters.
Right, the underdog.
Exactly. They're hiding out in caves. They're facing these seemingly impossible odds. And eventually, they overthrow the massive tyrannical empire.
It's the ultimate narrative, really. I mean, it feels
Definitely.
incredibly good to consume because it's just so morally clean.
Yeah, totally black and white.
Right. When you're looking at a small group fighting for their right to simply exist against a huge occupying force, you know exactly who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
But so here's the question that all those blockbuster movies and grand stories almost never stick around to actually answer.
Seriously.
What happens next? Like, what actually happens when those exact same heroic freedom fighters, the ones who bled in the dirt for liberty, what happens when they actually win the war?
Yeah, that's the messy part.
It really is. And more importantly, what happens when their children and then their grandchildren get a taste of absolute power? Do they stay heroes?
Rarely.
Right. Or do the descendants of the rebels eventually become the very villains their grandparents fought to destroy?
And that is the incredibly uncomfortable question at the heart of our material today. We are looking at a historical case study of how rapidly the oppressed can, well, adopt the tactics of their oppressors.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're immersing ourselves in this fascinating lecture by Dr. Anthony Tomasino. It's titled Judaism Before Jesus, the Hasmonean Dynasty.
It's a fantastic lecture.
It really is. And our mission for you today is to trace this shocking, almost unbelievable evolution of the famous Maccabean Revolt.
Because it's quite an arc.
Oh, it's a massive arc. We're going to look at how a righteous, totally necessary fight for religious freedom warped into a dynasty that was just steeped in paranoia, political assassination, tomb raiding, and eventually the mass crucifixion of their own people.
Yeah, it gets incredibly dark. If you could see the backdrop behind me right now, you would be looking at a map of the ancient Near East.
Just a tiny speck initially.
Exactly. Over the course of our conversation today, you'd watch the Judean territory slowly expand from that tiny, vulnerable speck on the map into a massive, wealthy kingdom.
But there's a catch.
A huge one. What the map doesn't show is that as those geographical borders expand, the moral center of the nation completely collapses. It is really a masterclass in the corrosive nature of absolute power.
So to set the baseline for you, we are starting right after a major historical turning point. Judas Maccabeus, the legendary heroic founder of the rebellion against the Syrian Greeks, he has just died in battle.
Right, this is roughly 161 BC.
Okay, so it's 161 BC. The rebellion is suddenly reeling. It's totally rudderless. And Judas's brother, a man named Jonathan, has to step up and take command of the Hasmonean troops.
Which is not an easy job.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So what is the actual political landscape Jonathan is inheriting here?
Well, Jonathan is stepping into a total power vacuum. The high priest in Jerusalem, who had been this somewhat controversial figure friendly to the Greek occupiers, he has just died.
Okay.
Now, you have to understand, the office of the high priest is the single most important religious role in Judaism. This is the guy who enters the Holy of Holies, the one who conducts the Day of Atonement to clear the entire nation's guilt.
It's a massive deal.
Huge. And suddenly, that office just sits empty. Or at the very least, it's filled by a placeholder who is so unremarkable that history has literally completely forgotten his name.
Wow. Okay, let's unpack this. Because Jonathan doesn't respond the way you might expect a rebel military commander to respond, right?
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't just march his army on Jerusalem with swords drawn to seize the temple. He does something way more subtle. He sets up a shadow government in a small town called Mishmash.
Just a little ways outside of Jerusalem.
Right, and he just starts dispensing justice and handling civil disputes from there.
It is a brilliant administrative pivot. Dr. Tomasino actually compares it to the biblical story of Absalom, King David's son.
Oh, right, the one who sat at the gates.
Exactly. Absalom set himself up at the city gates to hear the people's grievances while his father was isolated and just languishing in the palace. It's this slow, methodical siphoning of authority.
I mean, I think of it like a modern startup completely outperforming a sluggish, bloated legacy
That's
corporation.
a great analogy.
Thanks. I mean, Jerusalem is the legacy corp. They have the massive infrastructure, the giant temple, all the centuries of history. But their leadership is completely failing the constituent.
Right, they're not getting anything done.
Exactly. So Jonathan sets up his nimble little startup in Mishmash, and suddenly the everyday citizens are flocking to him because he is actually doing the work. But I have to push back on this transition a bit.
Okay.
How does a guerrilla fighter, a guy who has spent his entire adult life ambushing troops in ravines, how does he suddenly become this savvy bureaucrat making backroom deals?
Well, because he recognizes that the geopolitical winds around him are shifting drastically. The Syrian Greek Empire that the Maccabees have been fighting is tearing itself apart in a civil war.
So they're distracted.
Extremely. You have these two rival Syrian factions, specifically Demetrius Sir and Alexander Balas, fiercely fighting for the throne. And Balas looks down at Judea, sees this highly effective, incredibly popular leader running a shadow government in Mishmash, and says, I need that guy's military support if I want to win.
So the Syrian king essentially bribes the leader of the Jewish rebellion.
He does. But the currency he uses for the bribe is just staggering. Balas appoints Jonathan to be the high priest in Jerusalem to buy his military loyalty.
Wait, how does that even work? If the role of high priest is so deeply sacred, how does the public just accept a foreign pagan king handing it out as a political favor?
What's fascinating here is that this completely shatters centuries of deeply held religious tradition. Since the days of King Solomon, the high priest legally had to be chosen from one specific aristocratic family line.
The Zadokite line, right?
Exactly, the Zadokite line. It was considered a perpetual, unbreakable covenant with God.
And Jonathan is a Hasmonean. He's from a family of rural priests who basically just took up swords. He's essentially from the wrong family line entirely.
He is. But Jonathan accepts the bribe anyway. In 153 BC, he puts on the sacred robes and actually presides over the Feast of Tabernacles. And on top of that, the Syrian king gives him the title of Strategos, which is chief military governor.
Wow.
Yeah, Jonathan has just merged church and state into a single office held by one man.
And you can immediately see the ideological compromise taking root there. The purity of the original rebellion is just officially dead at this point.
Without a doubt.
Jonathan is now a political player, making shady alliances with the exact same empire he was supposed to be dismantling. And for you listening, playing geopolitical chess when you're a small nation caught between massive empires, it rarely ends well.
It certainly ends poorly for Jonathan. A rival Syrian general named Tryphon eventually lures Jonathan to a supposedly friendly city with the promise of bestowing even more honors on him.
Let me guess, a trap.
Total trap. Jonathan is captured, held for ransom, and eventually executed.
And the real tragedy is that his family explicitly warned him it was a trap, but the allure of that political power just blinded him.
It did.
So Jonathan is dead. His brother Simon takes over the dynasty, and Simon actually manages to negotiate a massive win, doesn't he?
He does. He gets the ruling Syrian king, Demetrius II, to completely exempt Judea from taxation, which in the ancient world essentially means they are an independent nation.
They don't have to pay tribute anymore.
Exactly. They even manage to finally expel the remaining Greek troops from their stronghold in Jerusalem. Because of this, Simon is officially recognized by the Jewish Great Assembly as both the legitimate high priest and the supreme leader.
So he's really consolidated everything his brother started.
Right, he's solidified it.
But the violent undercurrent of this family, it just doesn't stop. Fast forward to 135 BC, Simon goes to a banquet hosted by his own son-in-law, a guy named Ptolemy.
And it does not go well.
No, his son-in-law murders him right there at the dinner table. And this assassination forces a massive structural pivot for the dynasty. Simon's violent death opens the door for his son, John Hyrcanus, to take the throne.
Which changes everything.
Yeah, this transition from Simon to John Hyrcanus is the exact moment the Hasmonean family stops defending a homeland and starts aggressively building an empire.
The psychological shift under John Hyrcanus is profound. We are moving from ideological survival to downright territorial conquest. And his reign begins with a deeply traumatizing event.
Right, with his mother.
Yes. Hyrcanus marches to take back Jerusalem from the son-in-law who just murdered his father. But Ptolemy, the son-in-law, has taken Hyrcanus's mother hostage. Every time Hyrcanus tries to breach the fortress walls, Ptolemy parades his mother out onto the battlements.
That is horrific.
It gets worse. He brutally tortures her in plain sight, threatening to kill her if Hyrcanus doesn't back down.
Which puts him in an impossible moral position. I mean, does he avenge his father and secure the nation, or does he save his mother?
Exactly. And eventually, Ptolemy executes her anyway. Hyrcanus is forced to watch his family just be decimated by political ambition. And initially, his reign is weak. He's besieged by the Greeks and forced to pay massive tributes.
But then the Greek king Antiochus VII dies in battle a few years later.
Right, and the Syrian Empire falls into total disarray. Hyrcanus sees his opening.
He goes on an absolute conquest spree. He marches north, he marches south, and this is where the historical hypocrisy becomes almost physically painful to look at.
It really does.
He marches south and conquers a neighboring region called Idumea. Now, the people living there are the Edomites.
Right. And remember the catalyst for this entire Maccabean revolt a generation earlier.
Oh, yeah. The Greek king forced the Jews, under threat of horrific execution, to give up their religion, abandon their laws, and adopt Greek culture. It was literally a cultural genocide.
And now John Hyrcanus, sitting as a Jewish high priest, conquers the Idumeans and forces them, under threat of death, to give up their religion and convert to Judaism.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. Are you telling me the Jewish high priest is using the exact same convert or die tactic that the Greek king used to spark the rebellion in the first place?
That's exactly what he's doing.
The oppressed have literally become the oppressors.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the context makes it even darker. There is ancient, incredibly bitter, bad blood between the Jews and the Edomites.
Going back a long way.
Right. You go all the way back to the Babylonian captivity, when Jerusalem was sacked and burned centuries prior. The Edomites were the ones who opportunistically bought the fleeing Jewish captives and sold them into slavery.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The biblical prophets spoke constantly about a coming day of divine judgment for Edom. So Hyrcanus likely rationalized this atrocity by telling himself he was delivering that righteous judgment.
Justifying it through religion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the irony of a forced conversion is a historical seed that will absolutely come back to haunt Judea.
But expanding an empire, keeping armies in the field year after year, that comes with a massive price tag. John Hyrcanus is practically bankrupting the nation to fund this aggressive expansion.
War is expensive.
Right. He needs a massive influx of cash. So yeah. Here's where it gets really interesting. To fund his ambition, he crosses a sacred line. He plunders a tomb.
And not just any tomb.
No, not just some wealthy nobleman's tomb. He breaks into and plunders the legendary tomb of King David.
He discovers the tomb is filled with centuries of accumulated riches, and he just empties it to rebuild his war chest.
I cannot get past the sheer audacity of that. How does a high priest, the spiritual shepherd of the people, look his followers in the eye and justify robbing the grave of Israel's greatest king?
It takes a lot of nerve.
It's the ultimate untouchable monument. And what exactly does he buy with that stolen gold?
He buys foreign mercenaries.
That is such a wild milestone. Up until this exact point, the Maccabees were a volunteer militia. They were fighting for their own homeland out of deep religious conviction.
Right. They were believers fighting for survival.
And now, Hyrcanus is taking stolen temple money and paying pagan foreigners to fight his wars of expansion. He even marches north and destroys the ancient Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim.
Which cements a bitter, violent hatred between Jews and Samaritans that lasts for centuries.
It's a total abandonment of the original ideals.
He is operating entirely as a secular pragmatist monarch, even while wearing the sacred robes of the high priest. He eventually dies peacefully in bed in 104 BC, the very first Hasmonean leader to do so, actually.
Well, good for him, I guess.
Yeah, but the moral rot he introduced guarantees that his children will tear each other and the country apart.
Which brings us to the descent into absolute paranoid tyranny. Enter Aristobulus, Hyrcanus' son. He takes over the dynasty in 104 BC. Now, Hyrcanus had actually written in his will that his widow was to be his political successor.
But Aristobulus wasn't having that.
No, he completely ignores his father's final wishes. He seizes power and throws his own mother in prison.
And he starves her to death.
He starves his own mother to death to secure his throne. He locks up almost all of his brothers in dungeons. And he is the very first Hasmonean leader to officially put a crown on his head and look at the people and say, "I am king."
Which, again, is a massive affront to traditional Judaism. The title of king was supposed to be reserved exclusively for the royal line of David. The Hasmoneans claiming the kingship is the final proof that their ambition has eclipsed their faith.
Aristobulus is deeply paranoid, but he does leave one brother out of prison, his favorite brother, Antigonus. And what happens next is straight out of a Shakespearean tragedy.
It really is. Aristobulus falls severely ill, and in his feverish paranoia, he passes a new law. Anyone who enters the royal palace wearing armor is to be killed on sight by the guards. no questions asked.
So a member of the royal court, who clearly despises Antigonus and wants him out of the picture, goes to Antigonus and says, hey, I just procured this beautiful top-of-the-line suit of ceremonial armor for you.
That's setting the trap.
Right. He says, you know who would absolutely love to see this? Your brother, the king. You should go show him right now.
And Antigonus, thinking he is honoring his brother, walks into the palace proudly wearing the armor, and the guards just cut him down instantly.
When Aristobulus realizes he has been manipulated into murdering the only brother he actually loved, he spirals. He goes on a massive drinking binge fueled by profound remorse, and his body just gives out.
He dies after ruling for barely a year.
Which clears the stage for the brother who had been locked in the dungeon the whole time, a man named Alexander Janneus.
And if you thought Aristobulus starving his mother was bad, Janneus is the undisputed architect of Judea's darkest hour.
He takes the throne and immediately marries Aristobulus's widow, a woman named Alexandra Salome. Janneus goes on to expand the national borders even further through sheer military brute force.
But at home, things are a mess.
Oh, totally. While he's occasionally successful abroad, at home, he is known by the people as the Mad King. He's carousing, he's violently unpredictable, and he heavily favors the wealthy aristocratic Sadducees over the everyday people.
Which causes massive friction.
Because of this, the Pharisees absolutely despise him.
And to clarify for you listening, the Pharisees were a major religious faction that represented the strict, traditional core of the public. They were basically the populists.
Just people's representatives.
Right. So when the Pharisees clash with the king, it's not just a political spat. It is a battle over the very soul of the nation, and they are not quiet about their hatred for him. Which leads us to the infamous Citron incident.
Yes. I want you to vividly picture this scene. It is the Feast of Tabernacles, one of the holiest and most joyous days of the Jewish year. Alexander Janneus, acting as the high priest, is parading around the temple altar in his sacred garments.
It's supposed to be a very solemn moment.
Right. And the worshippers and the massive crowd, they're holding a palm branch in one hand and a citron in the other as part of the ritual.
And a citron is essentially a type of lemon.
Yeah, exactly like a lemon. As Janneus steps up to the altar, the crowd is so utterly fed up with his corruption, his secular warmongering, and his blatant hypocrisy that they just start pelting him with lemons.
It is a massive, spontaneous public humiliation of a tyrant.
And Janneus snaps, and he doesn't just order the guards to arrest the agitators. He orders his mercenary troops to draw their swords and attack the crowd.
It's just brutal.
A Jewish high priest slaughtering thousands of unarmed Jewish worshippers right there in the temple courts.
It permanently fractures the nation. By 88 BC, the Pharisees are so desperate to rid themselves of this monster that they do the unthinkable.
What do they do?
They reach out to the Seleucid Empire, the Syrian Greeks, the exact same empire the Maccabees fought a bloody war to expel, and they invite them to invade Jerusalem and overthrow their own king.
Just let that sink in for a second. The situation is so dire that the descendants of the original rebels are inviting the foreign occupiers back in.
The Syrian Greeks accept the invitation and march on Jerusalem. Janneus's army is crushed. He is quite literally backed into a corner and about to be wiped out.
But then this incredible psychological twist happens on the battlefield.
It's fascinating.
The Judean citizens look at the approaching Greek army and something ancestral triggers in them. They remember the atrocities of the past. They remember the cultural genocide their grandparents endured.
And they switch sides again.
Right. They rally around Janneus and actively fight off the Greeks.
It is the ultimate devil you know scenario. They hate Janneus. But the generational trauma regarding the Greeks is so deep that they actively shield the high priest who just massacred them in the temple.
They save his life. They save his throne. And how does Alexander Janneus say thank you to the citizens who just rescued him?
This is the darkest moment of the Hasmonean dynasty. Janneus rounds up the leaders of the Pharisees who opposed him, 800 men, and he crucifies them all in the center of Jerusalem.
A mass crucifixion. Implemented by a Jewish king against his own people.
And while those 800 men are agonizing on the crosses, Janneus has their wives and their children dragged out and slaughtered right in front of them.
That is just evil.
And meanwhile, Dr. Tomasino knows from the historical records, Janneus is up on his palace balcony, hosting a banquet and cavorting with his concubines, watching the entire slaughter as evening entertainment.
It is genuinely stomach-churning.
This raises an important question. How does a nation even begin to process that level of trauma? You fought a brutal war of independence to escape foreign monsters, only to realize a few generations later that the monster is now wearing the robes of your own high priest.
That's unthinkable.
The psychological scar left on Judaism by Alexander Janaeus is immeasurable.
He eventually drinks himself to death in 76 BC, leaving behind a completely shattered, traumatized nation. But surprisingly, his death doesn't immediately lead to the collapse of the kingdom.
Yeah, there's a reprieve.
Yeah, we actually get a brief, profound golden age, and it is all thanks to his widow, Queen Alexandra Salome.
Which is fascinating, considering the historical precedent. The last time Judea was ruled by a queen was Athalia, centuries prior, and her reign was an absolute bloodbath.
Right.
But Alexandra Salome, however, takes the throne and is almost universally loved.
Because she was seen as a victim of Janaeus's cruelty, just like the rest of the country, she survived the Mad King.
Exactly. And the moment she takes absolute power, she completely flips the script on how that power is used.
How so?
Well, Janaeus had ruled with brutal hard power, persecuting the Pharisees and favoring the aristocratic elite. Alexandra reverses that entirely. She utilizes soft power. She brings the Pharisees back into the fold, gives them significant public office, and sidelines the corrupt elites.
So what does this all mean for the average person living in Judea? I want you to imagine the absolute whiplash of the everyday citizens.
It must have been surreal.
You've lived through decades of royal bloodshed, paranoia, forced conversions, mass executions, and suddenly it all just stops. The kingdom can finally breathe.
The later historical rabbis actually look back at her reign as a literal golden age. She didn't launch any aggressive, bankrupting military conquests, but through savvy diplomacy, she also didn't lose an inch of the territory her predecessors had taken.
So it was stable.
Very stable. It was a period of profound peace, economic security, and importantly, a complete lack of royal scandal.
But the true tragedy of Queen Alexandra Salome is that her golden age was only a pause because she has two sons.
Yes. Hyrcanus Medic, who she appointed to be the high priest, and Aristobulus II, who she put in charge of the military.
You would think these two men, having watched their mother successfully heal a fractured nation through peace and diplomacy, would learn from her example.
You would hope so.
But they learned absolutely nothing. As soon as Alexandra Salome is on her deathbed, the toxic, power-hungry ambition of the Hasmonean line flares right back up.
They couldn't help themselves.
The two brothers immediately turn on each other. Aristobulus II uses the military to seize the high priesthood, declares himself king, and sends his brother into exile. The peace their mother built is shattered instantly.
And that fraternal civil war is the final spark. It completely destabilizes the region, heavily weakens the borders, and paves the way for foreign intervention.
The Romans, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because they are too busy fighting each other, the Roman Empire simply marches in and occupies Judea, effectively ending the independent Hasmonean dynasty forever.
It is a dizzying, tragic arc. When you look at the whole picture we've painted today, we started with heroic freedom fighters hiding in caves, fighting purely for their right to exist.
The classic underdog.
Right. And within just a few generations, their descendants are high priests, robbing King David's tomb to hire foreign killers. They're forcing their neighbors to convert at sword point. And ultimately, you have a paranoid king crucifying 800 of his own people while throwing a party on his balcony.
The core lesson here is timeless, which is why we study it. Power, without stringent ethical constraints and accountability, is incredibly corrosive.
It rots from the inside out.
It really does. It doesn't matter how righteous or pure your initial cause is. The line between fighting monsters and becoming one is terrifyingly thin, and the Hasmoneans didn't just cross it, they sprinted right past it.
Which brings us back to where we started, that classic underdog story. We all love watching the scrappy rebels overthrow the evil empire, but I want to leave you with a lingering thought to mull over today as you go about your week.
What's that?
If Judas Maccabeus, the man who started it all, who bled in the dirt to free his people from tyranny, if he could have looked a century into the future and seen his own great nephews crucifying fellow Jews just to hold on to a political crown, would he have even started the rebellion in the first place?
It is a haunting question.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the historical narratives you think you know. We'll see you next time.